Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 172 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. If you'd like to support this podcast, please go to caropop.com. This week's episode marks the return of Joe Boyd, the producer and record label owner who previously discussed his work with Pink Floyd, Fairport Convention and Richard Thompson, Nick Drake, REM, and others in Caro Pop episodes 57 and 58. I encourage you to go back and check them out. Now, the U.S.-born Boyd, who still lives in the U.K., has written a massive, highly entertaining, and illuminating book about world music called And the Roots of Rhythm Remain. He's about to launch a U.S. speaking tour as well. Did you pick up on where the title And the Roots of Rhythm Remain comes from?
These are the roots of rhythm and the roots of rhythm remain.
It's a lyric in the Paul Simon song Under African Skies from his groundbreaking 1986 album Graceland. Boyd, now an energetic 82, had known Simon for a while when they ran into each other at a party. And Simon played him the backing tracks of this album in progress and sang his parts live over them.
You're talking about diamonds on the soles of his shoes.
Boyd, who already was releasing global music on his Hannibal label, knew Simon's work was a game changer. At the time, Simon was criticized for working in South Africa, yet Boyd credits him and Graceland with helping to end apartheid. Graceland is a jumping-off point for Boyd's explorations of music from around the globe, with stops in Jamaica, Cuba, Brazil, India, Russia, and other parts of Eastern Europe, as well as the southern United States and beyond. This book is not just about music indigenous to these places, but how it moved from culture to culture. In this conversation, he tackles big thematic questions regarding the origins of and inspiration behind this music. How much does music need cultural cross-pollination to grow and to thrive? Where's the line between proper and improper cultural appropriation? How much of a factor has oppression played in great music? How much of a factor has religion played in great music? And how often are those two factors tied together? Given that Boyd was stage manager at the 1965 Newport Folk Festival as Bob Dylan went electric, I had to ask him what he thought of a complete unknown. He gets into what was true, what was false, and what may have been false, but felt true. Given that Boyd produced REM's third album, Fables of the Reconstruction, there's also a bit of chit-chat about previous Caro Pop guest Mike Mills and that band as well. Boyd has a deep knowledge of music and how it works, and time flies when he's telling the stories, whether on the page or in conversation. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with Joe Boyd.
When the world's a monster, bad swallow.
The actor Michael Shannon and local for me musician Jason Narduzzi, they have a band together and they're touring Fables of the Reconstruction around the country right now.
Right. They call it Reconstruction of the Fables.
There you go.
And I got an email from Burtis Downs, you know, the manager, saying that they were coming to Athens. And I think there are... I guess the last time they came to Athens, Mike and Michael kind of turned up.
So and Peter and Bill. I think all four of them were there.
Oh, really? Yeah, Bill as well.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. This is the classical music. You know, it's like, you know, this music just keeps going round and round in different forms and people don't let it go. It's good.
Yeah, well, I'm sure I said this last time we spoke, but that's really always been one of my favorite REM albums, including the sort of murky atmosphere about it. There's just something about that record that it's like, I want to take a long train trip at night and put on that record and close my eyes.
That's good. I hope it doesn't put you to sleep too quickly.
No, not at all. But it puts me in a different state than the one I'm in before I start listening to it, and that's the key part of it. That's I get my REM experience out of that.
Right. Cool. Great. Well, I'm looking forward to coming to Chicago, and I've gotten used to doing these things. I mean, it's great if there's somebody on stage with me, particularly somebody that draws an audience of theirs. And then it can expand the audience, but I'm quite used to doing it. My wife, Andrea, travels with me, and she has all kinds of music related to the book queued up on her laptop. And we have photographs that we can project and stuff like that. And And we got it down pretty good. I think it's I think it works pretty well. And it's good to do sometimes something different where somebody, another personality comes on stage and asks you questions that you haven't thought of. That's always fun, you know, but we're also very happy to do it on our own. And that's what we're going to do in Chicago.
Well, if you have music queued up, I mean, that your book just sends, I mean, as much as your book is not a celebration of modern technology and music, the one way that the modern technology is helpful is that you could read about some of these songs, then kind of go online and listen to it and sort of create the soundtrack for reading this very, very rich book of yours that you've written. You know, there's so much here. You worked on it for what, 15 years?
About that, maybe a little more. it wasn't full time. It wasn't, it's the exclusion of all else. Although that, starting with the lockdown, the COVID lockdown, it was pretty much like that.
There you go. Well, and also a book like this, it's really drawing on this entire life you've had in music. So, you know, you weren't working on the book when you were running Hannibal, but you were accumulating a lot of the knowledge and experience and,
Yeah, and some of the anecdotes that I tell in the book go back to, you know.
How much about this music lives on because of the combinations of cultures, as opposed to, you know, a song growing out of a culture, you know, whether it's, you know, reggae and ska coming out of Jamaican culture, the fact that it, you know, then goes to Britain, or that, you know, so many of these different, you know, musics go to different places and then come back. I mean, is that where the magic happens?
A lot of it. I mean, I think every kind of music you look at is mongrel, you know, and it goes in all directions, you know. Just reggae ska being a good example. Ska is actually a Jamaican attempt to play jump blues from the early 50s, late 40s, early 50s. So it wasn't really Jamaican. It's kind of Jamaicans imitating Americans. And with the American music they're imitating has that syncopation that came into America through New Orleans from the Spanish Caribbean. And, you know, so everything, and you go to the other end of the world and I discovered, you know, that this caste from Rajasthan left India in the 5th century AD and started moving west. And that turned out to be the people who got called gypsies, and we now call Roma. And they transformed the music everywhere they went because they were just so good at it. And they had all this kind of Indian subculture, sense of scale and improvisation and all this stuff. And they just transformed the music where they went into Turkey, into Greece, into the Balkans. And, you know, and eventually, you know, one of the fruits of all of that is Django Reinhardt, you know. And
right.
And then I love, one of my other favorite quotes from the book is, I stumbled on this in a book about Django, is that B.B. King, when he was really young, when he was just starting out on the guitar, he stumbled on a Django Reinhardt record. And it completely blew his mind. And that whole single string melodic way of playing a blues solo, you know, obviously there's influences from lots of blues players and maybe Charlie Christian and T-Bone Walker and all of that. But the fact that he acknowledges the influence of this Roma from France on his blues playing, it all comes full circle, because Django was obsessed with American jazz and wanted to be known as a jazz player. But he was a Roma, you know, and then he influenced B.B. King. And so, you know, it just never ends. Every kind of music you dive into, you find these connections.
Right. I mean, there's a lot of talk, you know, you hear, especially now, about like appropriation of cultures or styles, whether it's music or whatever. But at the same time, almost everyone who starts out as an artist begins by kind of copying someone that they like, you know, whether it's the Beatles singing Motown songs, or Paul trying to sound like Little Richard, or, you know, Elvis Presley, you know, doing what he did with those songs. I mean, like, where's the line? I mean, do you need a certain amount of cultural appropriation for all these art forms to grow?
I think you do. I mean, I think you need influence. You certainly need influence. But there is, I mean, there are examples, and I cite some of them in the book, of improper appropriation. And actually, since I finished the book, since the book has been published, there has a documentary has come out on Netflix called The Lion's Share, which is about The Lion Sleeps Tonight, which was appropriated from right. Wimoway, which was appropriated from Mbube, and how, you know, nothing of these royalties ever got back to South Africa until very recently. And even then, you know, I've had to slightly rewrite, you know, a sentence for the paperback edition because I thought it ended a little more happily than it actually did. And in watching this documentary, you see that they got paid for a while, but the payment at a certain point stopped because there was an agreement with Disney and it came to an end. I didn't realize the agreement with Disney had a timer on it. And so it's now back to where it was before with very, very moderate, very small amounts of payments going back to the original creator of that melody. And right. that is appropriation.
And then Pete Seeger's in the middle of all of that.
Yeah. And tried, you know, he said, you know, make sure the guy gets some money. But, you know, he was on tour. He's not a lawyer. His publisher made sure that they kept a big chunk, and money may have gone to a lawyer in Johannesburg who never paid it to Solomon Lynde's family. And I start the book with Malcolm McLaren.
Right.
Going to South Africa, using many of the same studio, many of the same musicians that Paul Simon used. But Paul Simon paid them well. When they contributed to a melody, he gave them credit and they received royalties on that. But Malcolm registered everything in his own name. And that's appropriation. You know, a lot of it comes down to copyright law.
Right. The book takes its title and the roots of rhythm remain from a Graceland song, Under African Skies. And yeah, early on, you're talking about the creation of Graceland. And that album, when it was being made, had controversy around it as well. And it still does to some extent. I mean, I know that the people in the band Los Lobos feel like he kind of took their musical contributions and didn't credit them. So there's kind of two sides of that one, even with that album.
Right.
But you also had, you know, this cultural boycott going on and apartheid. And you certainly make the argument that, you know, a lot of that political stuff kind of went by the wayside once people heard this music, because the music connected on such a profound level that it, you know, that it was powerful, and, you know, more powerful than, you know, enforcing some sort of political boycott or something like that.
Well, and there's a couple of things there that I think people haven't really talked about that I want at least to make people aware of. The fact that not only did I think Graceland help end apartheid because of the sympathy that it engendered, and the fact, you know, whatever it was, 6 months after it was released, Congress overrode Reagan's veto on establishing an official boycott of South African goods. But more important, all this time that people were at the ANC and people were criticizing Paul Simon, people were giving Tony Awards and BAFTA Awards, you know, awards in Britain to Athol Fugard plays, Father, you know, Master Harold and the Boys, Tisby Banzi is Dead. These are great plays. But the productions that were so won so many awards that played on the West End and in Broadway were South African productions created in Johannesburg by white South African directors and black South African actors, brought as a package to the West End. What's the difference between that and Graceland? And nobody ever criticized those plays. Everybody thought those were great.
Right. And people now forget that anyone ever criticized Graceland, because that's become this landmark work of music. So
Yeah. Well, but people don't forget because, I mean, they're all the documentaries, you know, the documentary about Graceland that came out about 10, 15 years ago has a big confrontation between Paul Simon and the ANC. And then the new documentary about Paul also mentions it. You know, it's not.
Right.
It never dies.
Yeah, I guess you're right. I was like in sort of in the broader culture, I think people just kind of hold that album up on.
Yeah,
this,
yeah.
Know,
I think in the broader
career peak for him, like you know maybe yeah. beyond anything he did with Simon and Garfunkel. And you had such a unique perspective on it because you're like at a party and he has all the music and without the vocals on it, and it sounds like he did sort of a karaoke version of Graceland just for you.
Yeah, it was incredible. I mean, he. You know, I'd known Paul not very well. I can't say I'm a great, you know, bosom friend of his by any means. But I met him in English folk clubs in 1965, 66. And he's such a great fan. You know, he's a real enthusiast. And I think after I met him in England, I hadn't seen him for a while. And then I ran into him at a gospel music concert in New York in a church in Greenwich Village where the Fairfield Four was singing. And I just walked in, you know, I was a bit late and I went up and sat in the gallery and I looked at who's sitting next to me, Paul Simon. Hi, Paul. You know, and we ended up talking gospel music after the show, you know, a lot. Anyway, so I ran into him in London. He was at this party because we have some mutual friends. And he started telling, I said, well, what are you up to? And he said, well, I'm here recording with Ladysmith Black Mambazo at Abbey Road. I said, really? Ladysmith Black, you know, I have Ladysmith Black Mambazo records. You know, nobody else has nobody's ever heard of them, except me. You know, I have the collector's egotism of like, oh, I know about this. Nobody else knows about this. And he said, yeah, I've been in South Africa cutting tracks with a rhythm section, and we got a record, and Ladysmith is singing on it. We're recording an extra track. They were recording Homeless. And I was kind of like, well, I don't know about that. You know, and he started talking about Umbaklanga, and I said, yeah, I got Umbaklanga records, you know. And he said, well, if you know about Umbaklanga, you know, I'll play you some stuff. You know, and we just sat down next to the hi-fi set, and people just kept talking. Nobody paid any attention. And he just puts this cassette in there and starts playing me these tracks. And he says, and then the song will go like this. And he starts singing the song into my ear, singing, you know, Diamonds on the Soles of Her Shoes. And I go, fuck, wow, this is pretty incredible stuff, you know.
Mm.
And it was amazing.
So he had all the lyrics at that point that he was singing them?
Yeah, yeah. By that time he'd written the lyrics. And then later, wow. When I, you know, this was 1986, you know, and so 23 years later or something, I emailed him and said, I'm writing this book. Can I talk to you? Can I, you know, interview you about all this? And he said, oh, man, I've talked about Graceland so much. I'm tired of talking about Graceland. I really don't want to talk about Graceland anymore. But, you know, I've known you a long time. You can have 15 minutes. Here's my phone number, you know. And so I called him up at the appointed time, and we talked for 2.5 hours, you know. And it was a great interview. And there, you know, there's so many nuances to it. That's the joy of this book, in a way, for me as a researching it. It kept me on my toes and kept me fascinated. Was, you know, the cultural context. I mean, you know, he told me something in that phone call, because I knew about the conflict between the ANC and the Zulus, and I knew that the whole politics thing wasn't so simple. So the Zulus were a very complicating factor in this because their opposition to Mandela. And he told me that when Miriam Makeba joined the Graceland tour, that all during the tour, she never once spoke to Joseph Shabalala or any of the Ladysmith group. And when she you walk past them in the backstage, you just look the other way, would never acknowledge them. And, you know, that bitterness between the ANC and the Zulus was palpable. And, you know, he gave me that image. I love that image of Miriam just turning away and wouldn't talk to them, wouldn't look at them.
Right. As much as you like to think of music as the great unifier, there's still other stuff going on.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Talking to him about it, you know, 23 years later, kind of what was the biggest sort of, I guess, surprise of the way that album had lived on, you know, compared to when, you know, originally it was going to come out? What was kind of the revelation of Graceland having been in the world for that long?
Well, for me, the biggest revelation in a way is the disappointment, not with Graceland, but with its effect on the music world. Because in a way, the title of my book is kind of a giveaway of my obsessions in this regard. To me, music lives in the rhythm. And, you know, in a way, the whole rock revolution and the rock world that we live in and we live have until very recently, we're living in, and, you know, is based on white kids getting the hang of blues rhythms, of R&B rhythms, and kind of slightly dumbing them down or simplifying them and making them very into a very powerful engine that has driven American music around the world. And what Paul did, and what I so admire in the way he approaches what he works on, when he went to South Africa, he did exactly what he'd done when he went to Jamaica years before. He starts with the rhythm section. What's the feel? What's the rhythm going to be? And he takes these geniuses and lets them play what they do best. And then he records a bunch of tracks, takes them back to New York, and writes lyrics inspired by what he's hearing. Most fusion records go the other way around. You know, they take a kind of mid-Atlantic rhythm of some kind, some Anglo-American beat, and they lay exotic melodies and great playing of a melody instrument or something on top of this. And to me, that's the wrong way around. And I kind of was hoping, I guess, that Graceland would unleash a kind of, I don't know, burgeoning of, you know, the world's top stars or the young bands that are coming onto the scene to start being inspired by rhythms from elsewhere, that we have rhythms from different cultures around the world as a basis for great popular music, broadly popular music. And right. Graceland proved that that's powerful when you do it right.
Yeah.
But like, very few people have done it. David Byrne a bit, you know, the right. Talking Heads.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, know. Remain in Light was 6 years before Graceland and was, you know, using all these kind of African musicians then.
Yeah.
So that was like this other kind of version of it. And then he had his first post Talking Heads record was a lot of Brazilian stuff.
Yeah, Ray Momo.
And Paul Simon was in Brazil with doing Rhythm of the Saints too. Peter Gabriel.
It's hard.
But there wasn't.
But Peter Gabriel, no. Peter Gabriel didn't really work that way. He worked the other way around, I think. I find most of Peter Gabriel's collaborations are kind of, to me, sort of the wrong way around. They're more blander rhythmically with rich exoticism in the melody lines.
Yeah, I guess if you went back to like 80, well, 80, he had his song Biko, which is the sort of built on this kind of tribal beat, and 82, Rhythm of the Heat, is kind of built around the rhythm. I mean, he worked so infrequently after So, and So was less, I mean, I guess In Your Eyes has some of that going on too. I don't know. I mean, it's almost like hip hop is what you're looking at in terms of a music genre being built around the rhythms and the beats, and then, you know, the rap's going on top of it, but so much of that is about the production and the creation of these rhythm tracks, but there's a lot more sort of electronics and drum machines and that sort of thing involved in that. But that's kind of your,
it's all
and hip hop is much bigger than rock right now too.
Of course. So I said, we talk about the world we lived in with rock until recently.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's no longer, rock is no longer ruling the roost by any means. But you know, it's fruitless to kind of try and be didactic and to try and preach to people. You know, that doesn't go very far. All I can do is describe wonderful eras and wonderful artists and wonderful music that people have heard much of. You know, they've heard bits and pieces of all of this stuff, but they don't really know the stories behind it. And so that's what my book set out to do.
Absolutely.
And if people end up liking rhythm that comes from two guys playing together in a room at the same time better than they like rhythms put together by an engineer with a beatbox and a computer, that's great. But, you know, I know I'm not going to change the world.
Well, there's something about the idea that, you know, so much of what you're writing about is musicians who could be recorded on the street with one microphone. You know, you could put a microphone in the middle of whatever they're doing and convey what it is they're doing to the rest of the world.
But actually not quite, because I don't really talk about this particularly in the book, but I think maybe it's implicit, but it's certainly part of my ethos as a producer, is I have huge admiration for ethnographers, for Alan Lomax, for you know, people who went around the world with one microphone recording people in the street, as you described.
Right.
But to me, I never really wanted to be part of that process. To me, music that is played by great musicians deserves to be brought inside and put into a studio with a really nice resonant sound and a high ceiling and a Neumann microphone put in front of them.
Sure.
You know, I believe in recording traditional music as if it was Miles Davis or a string quartet or a Bob Dylan record, you know, whatever, the top of the line, the best for these guys, as far as I'm concerned, which is, I guess, the two extremes that I've always resisted, I've tried to stay between. On the one hand, the sort of authenticity field recording aesthetic, in which the sound quality doesn't matter, you're just documenting something. And on the other hand, over polishing it to try and make it into something it isn't, which is what I think happens a lot at
right.
real world studios, for example, you know, with Used to Endure Records, you know, that became overcooked, overproduced, over presented somehow. To me, the golden mean is in the middle, is leave the music alone, but record the hell out of it in a really best possible way you can.
Yeah, and I wasn't saying sticking a microphone in the middle of something is the optimal way to present the music. I was just saying that these musicians are people who you could capture their, I mean, it's better to record them in a studio, but you could capture their essence, what they're doing almost anywhere, as opposed to a lot of these studio creations where it's like built, these productions that are built track by track, and it's not something you would ever encounter, you know, just on a little tiny stage or sidewalk somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, I agree.
Ahora lo aprendí a decir, pero nunca olvidaré lo que me hizo sufrir. What you said, ay, si no quiere pasar lo que pasé.
Habla inglés.
Se dice al derecho y se escribe al revés.
Caropop is supported by Revolution Brewing, Illinois' largest independent brewery. Revolution's great offerings include the classic Anti-Hero IPA, the non-alcoholic sparkling hop water Super Zero, and the premium lager Cold Time. As the weather warms up, Cold Time sure hits the spot. It's an all-malt beer featuring Midwest two-row barley, Mexican lager yeast, a touch of German hops, and pure Great Lakes water. It's never pasteurized, and the brewed low and slow badge on the can attests to a lower temperature fermentation that mellows the beer for a smoother, more flavorful sip. How much of an ingredient in great music has oppression been?
I think quite a lot. I mean, it's hard to quantify, but I know that historically, it's not a principle. I mean, to me, most things that people might hear from me, might coming out of my mouth, that sounds like a principle, is actually more of an observation. Like if I hear 10 artists or 10 tracks or 10 different kinds of music that I really like, and then I step back and I look, oh, what do these things have in common? Well, one thing that a lot of music that I love has in common is defiance, is anger, is standing up against something. And very often, you know, like a big culture that's trying to belittle or suppress a smaller culture. Or, you know, someone representing the voice of the ordinary person in a culture where that is disrespected and suppressed. Or straight up protest song, you know, like from Fela Kuti to Andy Palacio. You know, it's like there's so many great artists whose that energy comes from defiance. And I think it you hear it in, you know, the Tropicalista movement in Brazil.
Right. I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah, which wasn't specifically political, but it was so interesting. In Caetano Veloso's book, he says that when he was arrested and he was being held in solitary confinement, one of his jailers, and he was having a conversation. He would have conversation with the jailers. And he said, you know, we never sang political songs. And the jailer said, but actually your deconstruction of culture is a greater threat than any political song. The jailer actually said that to him.
Wow. It's such an affirmation of the power of music, even though you don't really want to hear it when you're put in a jail cell. But the idea that sort of, again, cross-pollinating these forms of music and breaking it down and reaching people is such a threat to, you know, oppressive regimes is something worth taking note of.
Yeah, and then the Brazilian junta was a classic example. I mean, there were lots of examples I read of a song would be released and they would it wouldn't even notice it and it would become a big hit. And then they'd realize, wait a minute, they're making fun of us in that song, and suddenly ban it. And the fact that they didn't get the joke made them even angrier. You know, the fact that there was, well, something's happening, but you don't know what it is, do you, Mr. General?
Right.
You know, it's a very powerful thing, which I think, you know, is animating a lot of what's going on in America right now. You know, this idea that there's a kind of hip culture out there that is making fun of Trump and the people on the right, and it makes them very angry.
Well, you know, seizing control of the Kennedy Center in the first couple weeks of the new administration is kind of a tell of the accent on the power of culture there.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it seems like most of the music in your book somehow grows out of, you know, oppressive, trying, difficult circumstances. You know, that the music grows out of that as opposed to just growing out of the sense of, oh, it's the joy of looking out at my garden or something.
I think it's true. I think that's the greatest driver of inspiration. I mean, Dylan is a puzzle, but, you know, because, you know, he leads us to the suspicion that his protest songs were kind of a shtick. that they were a career move more than they were something sincere. And yet they couldn't be that good without it being representing something real, a real defiance. And you can see in his personality in those early years how defiant he was. And eventually he shifted his defiance from an oppressive government or racists or warmongers to the folk establishment. You know, he became defiant against them, and that fueled those great record, you know, those great first electric records, you know, Blonde on Blonde and Highway 61 Revisited, and those were defiant records. And I think it's not always absolutely clearly political, but I think defiance is a very, very important ingredient in much great music.
Yeah, I mean, his writing starts out very, you know, directly protesting oppression and injustice, and later it gets much more surreal, and yet you look back on it and like, well, that was maybe more revolutionary. You know, the revolutionary music might have been him singing Ballad of a Thin Man and Like a Rolling Stone and, you know, all these other songs that would go on for 8 minutes with all verses and no choruses. But the way he was sort of upending your sense of what was established and what was sort of iconoclastic, you know, he changed stuff. And, you know, I think in your book also, to just go back to Paul Simon for a second, you know, someone's asking him like, well, why aren't you writing political songs? And it's like, on Graceland, the lyrics are not political. That's not what he's doing. And yet there's this huge political effect to what he's doing. And that, as you're saying, you think it helped speed the end of apartheid.
Yeah. But as Paul says, he says the quote I give in there is, I'm not a good, angry songwriter.
Right.
You know, and I think that's true. I think Paul Simon probably isn't. I mean, he has this sort of, even when he's betrayed by girls in love songs or whatever, he's kind of, okay, I get it, you know. he's like, he's not an angry songwriter, which, and I'm not saying that defiance is essential to great music. It just is often an ingredient.
Right. Yeah, and then Dylan, obviously there is a tremendous amount of defiance in those, again, in those, you know, early electric songs, post, you know, protest songs, that still communicates like an anger and, you know, energy that you could sort of grasp on, and like there's something going on and you don't know what it is, and we know what it is and you don't. And that's rough to hear. Did you see A Complete Unknown, by the way? Since you were actually at Newport and handed him the electric guitar. Like, what was your take on seeing that on screen?
Well, obviously they played fast and loose with some of the facts.
Sure.
But I thought, hey, that's what happens. You know, that's what people do. That's what movies, that you have to do that to make a movie. And it credited the actor playing me that I was the sound engineer, which I wasn't. Paul Rothschild was the sound engineer. I was on stage. He was at the soundboard. There was never a fist fight at the soundboard. But, you know, generally, I thought it was pretty amazing. I thought, you know, for the first 45, 50 minutes, I was kind of watching it from an emotional distance. Like, I knew that person. It didn't look like that, but not too bad. I knew that street. I knew that club. I knew I was there when that happened. I was just assessing it and thinking it was a little bit bloodless. And then there's that scene in the radio station where Pete Seeger's in a session live on air with a blues singer, and New Earth and Dylan show up. And the blues singer is drinking and he's giving Seeger a hard time and he's kind of a jerk. And Dylan and New Earth are both kind of jerks. And the whole thing gets kind of weird and chaotic. And at that point I said, okay, now we're talking. This is a little bit what it was like.
And that's an invented scene too, right? I don't think that actually...
Yeah, I don't think it really happened. And certainly there's no blues singer who fits exactly that description. But I thought, this is the mood. And then from that point on, particularly the relationship between him and Baez, which I thought was terrific in the film. I thought, unfortunately, Susie Rodolo wasn't very...
I agree.
Three-dimensional. She was pretty flat. And I knew... I mean, the funny thing is, you know, she left to go on this trip to Italy. And you imply, and I think it seems to be clear, that Dylan was pretty upset that she went away. But then he was on to other things by the time she came back. And they kind of, and then she said, I can't do this. Not at Newport, but she at a certain point said, I'm out of here. I think once she realized what was going on with Baez and what a star he was becoming. And I met her around that time in the village, and I thought she was great. And I asked for her phone number, you know. And I actually called her up to try and ask her out, you know, but she wasn't home or something, or I never got through to her. And then I had to go away and go on the road for George Wein or do something different, and the whole thing, you know, frittered out. But I remember thinking, wow, she's really cute and really smart, and Dylan's gone on to Joan Baez, so
there you go.
I'll give her a call. And I was a bit disappointed in her portrayal, but I thought it was very, I mean, really quite remarkably good and much better than I expected.
Aside from, you know, adding the Judas thing from the later Royal Albert Hall concert, Did the mood of what happened at Newport, did that fit, or was it a little over the top? Like that sense of outrage? Because obviously the movie doesn't get into showing that he did an acoustic set the night before, or, you know, like other things that you just can't fit into a movie.
Right. It was not far off. It was a little off in the sense that there were equal cheers. You know, to me, my impression of the sound of the crowd was 50-50, boos and cheers. And of course, once he'd finished the three numbers, more sounds like boo, you know, the long vowel can't be distinguished. So so I think they overdid the booing and the outrage a bit, but not with the backstage, you know, certainly the way they portray Lomax and Bickel and their anger and everything. And Pete Seeger, one image that I loved was the year before when Johnny Cash is on stage and Dylan's in the wings, and you just have this shot of the stage before Johnny Cash comes on. And what is on the stage? A drum kit. Johnny Cash's Tennessee 3 drum kit.
Right.
That's the big thing on the stage. So it's like, excuse me, there have been drums on this stage before, you know, and it's almost like the director made that point by just having a year before the biggest item on the stage is a drum kit. And anyway, I thought that was pretty good.
I had a friend who's a music critic who posted on Facebook. He said that at Newport, one of the reasons there was negative reaction was just because back then concert sound was so different, and the sound, you know, the folk festival was all mic'd for acoustic stuff. So when Dylan came out, it was just really blary and loud. And like, it's like he was almost making it like they were complaining about the sound quality as opposed to the fact that he was betraying the folk movement.
Which is to a certain degree true, because one of the points I made in White Bicycles is that moment, you know, Maggie's Farm, that moment is the birth of rock. Nobody used the term rock before then, and not even then, not until 6 months later or a year later.
As opposed to rock and roll, right?
Yeah, there was rock and roll, there was R&B, there was pop music, there was folk rock. That wasn't even folk rock yet. There might have been. Actually, maybe that was how it evolved. People might have started using the word folk rock about what was going on in the village with Richie Havens and, you know, the Love and Spoonful and things like that. And But a lot of it, you know, one of the things that I objected, one of the things I think they got slightly wrong, there were two things, actually, the two mistakes, just in details, that the filmmakers made. One was zebra crossings, pedestrian crossings.
Mm.
You see them all over the place in this movie. They didn't exist. Nobody even thought of that. It was completely unseen. Nobody ever had a zebra crossing in Greenwich Village until at least the 70s. They didn't exist. That's one thing. The other thing is, on a stage, when you have a shot from the stage looking out at the audience, there's a monitor. Like for the artists to have up, hear themselves.
Right.
There were no monitors. We never heard of such a thing. It didn't exist. And there were no direct inputs either. Basically, in those days, and there were, we actually mic'd the amps, but very few people did. So that Bloomfield and Dylan and the bass and Jerome Arnold, the bass player, they were used to just cranking up their amps to be heard. And there's a big crowd. There's however many thousand people, and they're and Bloomfield was determined to be loud. You know, he wanted to be heard in the last row. And so once you have amps that are cranked up, you got to crank the voice up to be over the sound of the guitars. And so the whole thing was probably the loudest thing anybody had ever heard. You know, and that was shocking for sure. And I think a lot of people said, oh, it was ugly, it distorted. I don't think so. I mean, you know, I can't be objective, but I know Paul Rothschild, if you listen to his productions, The Doors, Janis Joplin, they sound beautiful. They're beautiful sounding records. He had a wonderful acoustic sensibility. He loved volume and he loved electric instruments and he, you know, probably enjoyed pumping up the volume a little bit, but he wouldn't have sat there in the third, you know, in the row G or wherever they were and distorted the sound. I mean, he didn't, he wanted it to be, the words to be legible. And, you know, I don't know. I think it was a shock that was very loud, but I think it was clear.
Was that the loudest music you had heard at that point?
Probably. I don't, you know, I guess I hadn't, I don't, you know, I've been in some clubs where it was pretty, I've been to hear Butterfield in Chicago, you know, the Near North Side. I can't remember the name of that club where he began playing. It was, anyway, it was in the Near North Side. It was just north of downtown.
Oh, I should know that.
Like the first, anyway, and then we went, Rothschild and Butterfield and I went up to see Bloomfield's band in Evanston. And that was really loud in a bar. And Butterfield got up to jam with Mike and it was Mike. They both were very loud. So in a smaller room, I definitely heard things that felt that loud.
Right. And you certainly heard a lot of loud music later in the UFO club.
In London, by that time, of course, everybody was very loud. And I think actually by 65, that summer of 64, when I stayed in London, I went to hear The Pretty Things in an underground garage. That was pretty loud.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the British bands were testing the limits of volume.
So to go back to your world of music in your book, how much of a factor is religion in a lot of that music?
Well, I think it's a huge factor in a lot of music and also a factor in the repression of music. But, you know, one of the things that was so fascinating that I uncovered in my research was this huge difference between Protestant North America and Catholic Spanish Caribbean and Catholic Portuguese Brazil, because the Catholics Well, there's so many things contributed to this, but the Catholics were pretty relaxed. You know, part of the, you know, such Protestantism and Catholicism are so different in what they see as the function of religion. You know, Protestantism, you sort of obey the rules. Calvinism, you have to act virtuous so that you prove that you're one of the virtuous chosen. Whereas the Catholics believe everybody's a sinner, you're going to sin. So you have to come confess and eat your wafer and drink your wine and be absolved. That's the deal. Sin, go ahead. Then come back to us on Sunday and, you know, go through the ritual. And so there was, in North America, there was very little intermarriage between, you know, recognized unions between white masters and black slaves. But in Cuba and Brazil, there was all kinds of stuff going on, and people buying their freedom, you know, people who had had a child with a female slave, freeing the son or daughter, or allowing them to buy their freedom or whatever. There was all these gray areas, and it was considered like the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire, which is the model, role model for the Catholic Church, they would conquer people and bring their gods to Rome and set up a temple and say, hey, go worship here, that's fine. And they did the same in Cuba and Brazil. They said to the people they'd captured in Africa, you want to build some drums? You want to have a fetish in the corner? You want to worship your god? You want to speak your old-fashioned language? Go ahead, knock yourself out on your day off. You know, rest of the time we're going to work you to death. But we found you lived longer if you had your music and your religion. And so they had different drums, different rhythms for each African god. And this kind of thing was completely forbidden in North America. No drums were allowed. And so you have this rich culture of drums in the Caribbean and Latin America, and a culture of no drums, but lots of singing and stringed instruments in North America. And these two cultures collide in New Orleans, and hence you have rock and roll,
Where does gospel
syncopation.
music fit into all of that with, you know, there's a lot of singing and clapping, so I feel like there's a lot of rhythm in gospel,
Yeah.
even if there's not a lot of drums in it.
There definitely is, but I think if you listen to, I mean, yes, there's for sure there was rhythm that was, in a lot of African dances that were, you know, before we have any recordings of anything, we're going back into the 19th century. But if you hear the church choirs, the Tuskegee, you know, Fisk Jubilee singers, this type of gospel singing from the 19th century and from the early 20th century is much more emphasis on vocal texture, Africanized, harmonies, playing fast and loose with Western chords, stretching them into different configurations, more than rhythm. But by the 20s and 30s, when you have those incredible records by those singing preachers, you know, and by Blind Willie Johnson and stuff like that, you can feel the rhythmic element coming in, and then you have Thomas A. Dorsey, Chicago native or a Chicago resident, you know, who changed everything by blurring the line between blues and gospel, and bringing the devil's rhythms into the church. Not that he was the original. I mean, he wasn't the only one. It was there beforehand. There was certainly a lot of rhythm and dancing. You know, going back to the dancing in Congo Square in New Orleans back in the 19th century, people talk about that. But there were not, but they weren't a lot, they had to do it with bare feet and hand claps and tambourines. they couldn't do it with drums because they were forbidden.
Hmm. Did a large percentage of this is really broad, like a large percentage of the music created in the world stem from some form of worship?
You know, I'm not enough of an expert ethnographer to properly answer that question, but I think, you know, anywhere you look, if you look at India, rags originated as temple chants. Those scales are all Vedic chants of some kind. And certainly African music, but again, it's like you can't draw a separation between religion and non-religion, because in Africa, religion is everything or nothing. You know, it's kind of omnipresent, bringing in the crops, you know, celebrating fertility, celebrating, you know, weddings, deaths, whatever. Gods are omnipresent, and the music is part of an awareness of that society in the context of the universe and a god or gods. Europe is kind of a more complicated story, and maybe if you delve into other cultures, they would be complicated this way too. But one of the things I found really fascinating in my research was, you know, the late 15th century and the beginning of the 16th century, you had Europe was on its knees. They'd had the bubonic plague, the Hundred Years' War. You know, they'd had this terrible time for more than a century, and the population had shrunk, and times were just awful. And the church's position generally was, it's your fault, you're sinners, this was God's vengeance on you, so you better focus on repentance. And the Roma came into the picture. They didn't care about what the church said. They didn't pay any attention to church dogma. They said, hey, we're going to play for a dance around the corner. You want to come? And they defied the church and played dance music constantly. And people loved that. And, you know, there's all these examples from history about Roma being run out of town or arrested or hung or branded or, but almost all of this was by the middle class, you know, or the authorities. The working class people thought the Roma were great because they brought cool stuff in and sold it in markets, and they told your fortune, and they played music, and in defiance of the church. So, you know, I think the role of religion is complex. It's inspirational at one end and a source of something healthy to be defiant towards on the other end.
Right. You know, for you, you grew up on the East Coast, you ended up in London. What was your light bulb moment of there's this whole other world of music out there that I didn't realize and that really excites me?
There were a series of them. When I was a little kid, my father's records were all from his mother had been a concert pianist, and he had a lot of classical music. But my mother's, her favorite records were Edith Piaf, Carmen Miranda, and Marlene Dietrich. These were kind of iconic figures for her. And I loved those records. And I actually probably was the one responsible for breaking them. You know, because I like playing them a lot. But of course, you drop a 78 when you're a kid and it breaks. And I forgot about some of them. And when I was about 19, I was at Harvard, and the Brattle Theater there had these rep seasons of, and I had heard about this film called The Blue Angel. I went to see The Blue Angel. And there's this moment where Marlene Dietrich gets up on stage and she sings Blonden Frauen, which is this real up-tempo number, which is, And I had completely forgotten about that record. And it was a record my mother had and that I had played endlessly when I was like 6 or 7 or 8. And I remember that music just pierced me to the heart. Like, oh my God, that music. Oh, I'd completely forgotten it existed. I just thought it was incredible. And I became kind of fascinated with Weimar Germany and all that stuff. And then, but constantly when the folk scene in Harvard Square, which I was discovering at around the same time, there was a feeling that discovering Doc Boggs and Robert Johnson was no different from discovering Joseph Spence and the other singers from the Bahamas, those Sam Charter's records of singers from the Bahamas. And I went with Jim Queskin and Jeff Moldor and, I don't know, a few other people down to Jordan Hall in Boston to hear Ali Akbar Khan in 1961. We just felt it was part of the panoply of all this wonderful music which was available to us. And then, you know, Michael Olatunji came through town at some point playing his drums of passion. And it was just, I don't know, it never seemed like something as a separate category. It was just like all this cool music that was out there. But I guess there was another moment which I remember very vividly, which was some years later, early 70s, I was living in L.A., and I was driving around, and I had the radio tuned to KCRW and Tom Schnabel, who was had a program called Morning Becomes Eclectic. And he put on Carlos Gardel singing Mano a Mano, which is a tango canción, a tango song. And that, I had to pull over the car to the side of the road to listen to it and write down the name of this guy after the announcement. And I go to Aaron's Records on Melrose and found a Carlos Gardel LP. And that was a moment where I began to collect records deliberately wider and wider geographically and to be more and more, just to feel like I have to cast my net for my record collection, you know, wider right. and wider and open my ears.
And then you put your money where your mouth was years later when you had a label and were able to release a lot of the stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
So, well, thank you so much. It was wonderful talking with you again. I really look forward to seeing you in person in Chicago at the Old Town School of Folk Music, and you'll be other places as well. And, you know, so I encourage anyone else who's listening to this to go see and hear his presentation.
Yeah, you can look, and on one of the big events on my tour is I'm going to be in residence, as they say, at Big Ears Festival in the cinema. I'm going to show the Jimi Hendrix movie and Amazing Grace and some movies that are connected to the book and talk and show stuff. And over the course of the 4 days of Big Ears in Knoxville, the last weekend of March.
All right. Well, thanks so much, Joe. Feel good. Travel well. And I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, good. Thanks a lot.
That's it for episode 172 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to Joe Boyd for sharing his deep insights about the world of music. The hardcover edition of And the Roots of Rhythm Remain is now available from Z Books, and the paperback will be out April 1st. It's quite a book, and Boyd is now launching a U.S. speaking tour to support it. On March 17th and 18th, he'll be in Saugerties, New York, presenting his 1973 documentary, A Film About Jimi Hendrix, and discussing the book. His book events also include appearances at Chicago's Old Town School of Folk Music on March 20th, in Minneapolis on March 24th, at the Big Ears Festival in Knoxville, Tennessee on March 26th, and subsequent dates in Atlanta, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Washington, D.C., and Brooklyn. For more information, go to joeboyd.co.uk. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Swake, who's got rubber on the soles of his shoes, at least last I looked. If you'd like to throw something into the Carol Pop kitty, we'd be much appreciative. You can give $24 or whatever you'd like at carolpop.com. Thanks so much for listening and for being here. I'm Mark Caro. Please follow Carol Pop on the so-called socials at Carol Popcast. You can follow me as well at Mark Caro at MarkCaro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Carol Pop Conversation. Thanks.